content of this program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. Hello, this is Fred Woodward from the Triangle Radio Reading Service. For the next hour, I'll be reading to you from The Week magazine, the best of the U.S. and international media each week. The Triangle Radio Reading Service wishes to thank Charlie and Carolyn Kerr for their support of today's reading of The Week magazine. This program honors Charlie's sister, Bonnie Cassidy, who continues to be a true inspiration to their family. And we are reading this week from the January 30th, 2015 issue of The Week magazine. And as usual, we start with the main stories and how they were covered. Obama's middle class economics. What happened? President Obama struck a defiant and ambitious tone in his sixth State of the Union address on Tuesday, claiming credit for successfully leading the U.S. out of recession and urging the Republican-controlled Congress to adopt a series of redistributive economic measures to help improve the fortunes of America's struggling middle class. The shadow of crisis has passed, he told lawmakers, citing improving job figures and strong economic growth. Today, we turn the page. Formally announcing plans that had been unveiled before the speech, Obama proposed closing tax loopholes on large inheritances, raising the top level of capital gains tax to 28%, and introducing a new tax on large financial institutions' debt. These reforms, he said, would generate $320 billion of revenue over a decade, which he would use to triple child care tax credits to $3,000, expand tax credits for education and married couples who both work, and make community college free for most students. Will we accept an economy where only a few of us do spectacularly well? Obama asked lawmakers. Or will we commit ourselves to an economy that generates incomes and chances for everyone who makes the effort? Making no mention of his party's heavy losses in November's midterm elections, Obama also pledged to veto any Republican attempts to dismantle the Affordable Care Act, his Wall Street reforms, or his executive action on immigration. On foreign policy, he urged Congress to lift the trade embargo against Cuba and to support his diplomacy-focused efforts to curtail Iran's nuclear program. In the GOP's official response, Iowa Senator Joni Ernst dismissed Obama's proposals as political talking points, not serious solutions. What the editorial said: President Obama's fiscal pipe dreams are amusingly detached from the reality of the largest GOP majority in Congress since 1949, said the Wall Street Journal. His class warfare proposals are DOA. But he's right about one thing. Middle-class incomes have plunged on his watch. Instead of trying to promote overall economic growth that would help everyone, Obama is offering more of the same excessive taxation and regulation that have done so much to reduce middle-class incomes. Obama deserves credit for beginning a full-throated debate about wealth concentration and the frustrations of the middle class, said USA Today. As the prospects of higher and lower income Americans have improved, the middle class has been completely left behind. Hourly wages have barely kept pace with inflation, and the annual median household income of $51,939 has not moved much in 25 years. Tweaking the tax code, however, won't address the real cause of middle-class misery. Globalization and technology have devalued labor. What the columnist said: Obama is acting like an internet troll, said John Pothoritz in New York Post. He clearly hopes his left-wing soak-the-rich proposals will send Republicans into a Pavlovian rage, further alienating them from an electorate already weary of Washington squabbling and gridlock. Yet had the president instead focused on securing bipartisan agreement on his immigration reform, which has the backing of a significant majority of Americans, he might actually have achieved something in his last 2 years in office. Alas, that's not how Barack Obama rolls, or rather, trolls. Actually, the president is playing a longer game, said Brian Beutler in NewRepublic.com, by establishing what he called middle-class economics as the Democrats' new brand, and daring Republicans to side with the 1%. He is essentially laying the foundation for Hillary Clinton's presumed presidential run in 2016. If Democrats adopt his mantra of reducing taxes on labor and raising them on capital, he could end up doing what Ronald Reagan did for Republicans: shape the parameters of the economic debate for years and years. The most striking aspect of Obama's speech was his cocky tone, said Chris Saliza in WashingtonPost.com. From start to finish, he was supremely confident, challenging and mocking Republicans at every turn. Bolstered by the improving economy and a surge in approval ratings, Obama is clearly feeling a renewed sense of purpose and mission. The takeaway message of the State of the Union: Obama isn't planning to go quietly. Not quietly at all. And from the "it wasn't all bad" category, an eighth grader from California put his Lego skills to work by inventing a low-cost Braille printer using little more than a plastic robotics kit, printer parts, and a computer chip. Shubhab Banjuri, 13, created the machine after learning that a typical Braille printer costs $2,000. Too expensive for many blind readers who just want to print out letters, shopping lists, and labels. Tech firm Intel was so impressed with Banerjee's Lego-based printer, which cost around $350, that it has provided the schoolboy with funding to further develop his school science project. "He's solving a real problem," said the Intel executive. Our controversy of the week: the GOP in 2016. Who will emerge from a crowded field? With a new Republican candidate jumping into the 2016 race every week, said John Dickerson in Slate.com, people are starting to wonder if the R next to a Republican's name stands for running for president. With Mitt Romney saying last week that he almost certainly will run again, there are now no fewer than 24 likely candidates for the 2016 GOP nomination, including Romney's fellow moderates Jeb Bush and Chris Christie. Tea Party favorites such as Rand Paul, Ted Cruz, and Ben Carson, social conservatives Mike Huckabee and Rick Santorum, and harder-to-categorize Senator Marco Rubio and Wisconsin Governor Scott Walker. Democrats can only cheer at each new Republican hat thrown into the ring, said Carol Lee in WSJ.com. 4 years ago, the GOP nomination battle was a farce, with Romney having to fight off a seemingly endless parade of outlandish candidates while the Democrats focused all their resources on the general election. Republicans had hoped to avoid a repeat of that fiasco, front-loading their primary calendar and limiting debates to help produce a presumptive nominee by the spring of 2016. But given the crowded field among Republicans and the lack of one among Democrats, who are united behind Hillary Clinton, history may repeat itself. Democrats would love another Republican clown car disgorging a dozen or more wannabes, said Ed Rogers in WashingtonPost.com. But it isn't going to happen. Mounting a viable presidential campaign this time around will require at least $40 million and up to $100 million, and that reality will quickly thin the primary field down to about five legitimate contenders. The GOP field for 2016 is much stronger than it was last time around, said Jennifer Rubin in WashingtonPost.com. This cycle's non-establishment candidates, such as Senators Cruz and Paul, are vastly more serious than the likes of Herman Cain and Donald Trump. Early on, Republicans usually flirt with the firebrands, but they ultimately give the nomination to an authoritative, seasoned pro. This year, everything is different, said Molly Hemingway in TheFederalist.com. Usually, the GOP's leaders and major donors rally early behind a single moderate candidate, leaving several true conservatives to divide grassroots support. But this time, Bush, Christie, and Romney will engage in a goat rodeo to be the GOP establishment's pick, leaving conservative challengers at much less of a disadvantage. The sheer size of the field will enable insurgent candidates like Paul and Huckabee to win primaries with just relatively small percentages of the vote, said Jonathan Tobin in CommentaryMagazine.com. Of the non-establishment candidates, Paul, the champion of the party's libertarian wing, probably starts out with the best chance, since he has a large chunk of voters already in his pocket. What the GOP needs is a hybrid candidate, said Caitlin Hoiberns in RealClearPolitics.com. That ideal candidate would be someone who's a Washington outsider, has governing experience, and appeals to both moderates and the party's base. Wisconsin Governor Scott Walker checks all those boxes, said Dan Baltz in WashingtonPost.com. A stolid Midwesterner, Walker may not light up rooms when he enters, but he has won two tough elections in a blue state and has a burning ambition to be president. He's endeared himself to fiscal conservatives by picking fights with unions, and as the son of a minister, he's fluent in the language of religious conservatives. Thus far, Walker's gotten little attention, but he's the real sleeper in this crowded field and may be ready to surprise at the moment it counts most. And the good news, bad news blurbs, it was a good week for faking it. After the launch of Invisible Boyfriend or Girlfriend, a new app that generates texts, voicemails, and pictures to give users believable social proof that they have a real-life soulmate. It was a good week for conspiracy theorists. After 130,000 pages from the Air Force's Project Blue Book, which tracked UFO sightings from 1947 to 1969, became available online, including some 700 objects that remain unidentified. It was a good week for praising dog. After a deputy at a Florida sheriff's office noticed that a new rug had been inscribed with "In Dog We Trust" instead of "God," the rug was auctioned off for $9,650, with proceeds going to Canine Estates, a local animal rescue center. But it was a bad week for hitting the drive-through. After a Georgia man was ticketed for distracted driving as he chomped on a McDonald's hamburger. "Maybe I was enjoying the burger too much," said Madison Turner, who says the cop told him, "You can't just go down the road eating a hamburger." It was a bad week for customer satisfaction after a New York City woman filed a lawsuit against the manufacturer of cushy foot shaping tights because the tights didn't give her the super satisfied feeling promised by the sexually charged advertising. And it was a bad week for decisive victories after a California high school girls basketball coach was suspended because his team won a game 161-2. "What are you teaching these kids?" said a local parent, angered by the suspension. "Are you teaching them to be a loser?" On the briefing page, we have France's alienated Muslims. Is it possible to be both French and a Muslim? The terrorist attacks in Paris have given that question a new urgency. How many Muslims live in France? The Republican secular principles forbid the collection of data on ethnicity and religion, but it's estimated that there are about 5 million Muslims, or 7.5% of the population. That's the largest Muslim community in Europe and makes Islam second only to Catholicism in the number of adherents to France, in France. Even before the Charlie Hebdo terrorist attacks, French society viewed this substantial minority with great ambivalence, and Muslims viewed French society with great ambivalence of their own. Only 27% of French citizens said they had an unfavorable view of Muslims, compared with 63% of Italians and 46% of Spaniards. But 74% thought that Islam was inherently incompatible with France's secular values. Those values leave the Muslim community largely alienated from the rest of France. They're not integrated into French society at all, said Soren Kern of the Gattestone Institute, a think tank. In a way, they're stateless. Why are there so many French Muslims? Most of them emigrated from former French colonies in Africa. About 1.5 million have roots in Algeria, 1 million in Morocco, and 400,000 in Tunisia. The influx began in the late 1940s when the French government needed to cover the labor shortfall caused by the Second World War. After former colonies gained their independence in the 1950s and 60s, immigration rules were relaxed, and many North Africans went to France for work. But the decades of colonial rule left many immigrants with a deep distrust of the French, nor were the French especially welcoming. Immigrants were largely housed in high-rise housing projects on the outskirts of the big cities like Paris, Lyon, and Marseille. 50 years later, many of these banlieues, or suburbs, have essentially become Muslim ghettos. What is life like in the banlieues? Joblessness runs at 20%, more than double the national average, and up to 40% among 15 to 24-year-olds. In some of the country's 751 sensitive urban zones, reports of crimes are ignored because police fear for their own safety. Discontent frequently boils over. In the autumn of 2005, weeks of rioting in banlieues across the country left 10,000 cars burnt out, hundreds of public buildings damaged, and a cleanup bill of $230 million. Since then, the government has spent $55 billion trying to improve these rundown areas, but many Muslims still feel that France doesn't care about them. People are happy the banlieues exist to cage up people they don't want to see or worry about, says Jib, a young resident of the Paris suburb of Clichy-sous-Bois. If we're out of sight and out of mind, c'est bien. Why are French Muslims so isolated? At the heart of the issue is laïcité, the principle that church and state must be completely separate, with no religious expression in the country's government, judiciary, or schools. Laïcité dates to the late 19th century and was originally directed at keeping the influence of the Catholic Church out of government. But many Muslims feel that secularism is now being used to attack Islam. In 2004, there was an uproar when lawmakers banned veils and other religious symbols in the classroom. In 2011, France became the first European country to ban women from covering their faces in public with a niqab or burqa. Why else do Muslims feel alienated? Many believe that the French, with their powerful sense of national and cultural identity, have never truly accepted Muslims, even those who are born in France. How am I supposed to feel French when people always describe me as a Frenchman of Algerian origin? Asked French-born writer Nadir Dindon. A 2010 Stanford University study found that a Christian job applicant of African heritage was 2.5 times more likely to be asked for an interview than an equally qualified Muslim with African roots. Perhaps most damaging, though, is the rise of the far right. Marine Le Pen, leader of the National Front Party, once compared France's rising Muslim population to the Nazi occupation. And she's currently leading polls for the 2017 presidential election. How many Muslims are radicalized? A small percentage, but enough to pose a serious threat. The Bandus and French prisons, where the inmate population is 60% Muslim, have become ideal recruiting grounds for Islamist extremists. More than 1,200 French Muslims have left France to join ISIS in Syria, more jihadists than from any other European country. Now France must deal with radicalized citizens waging jihad within its own borders. Among Muslims, the response to the Charlie Hebdo attacks was very telling. While most opposed the violence, a few French Muslims jumped on the Je suis Charlie bandwagon. Most view the magazine's mockery of Islam's prophet as a symbol of the humiliation French Muslims experience every day. We have high unemployment, high poverty. Religion is all we have left, explains Mohamed Benikdan, a transit worker in Paris. And yes, we have a hard time laughing about it. Move on now to the columns. Take two from the U.S. this week. The first from Peter Werner at the New York Times. Conservatives who aren't conservative. The right wing of the Republican Party is chronically furious, said Peter Werner. Tea Party conservatives just mounted an unsuccessful attempt to depose House Speaker John Boehner, even though he helped his party gain its largest majority since the Truman administration. Boehner's crime? He doesn't share their apocalyptic view of American life during the Obama era. Ben Carson, a presidential contender and Tea Party favorite, recently said the U.S. is now very much like Nazi Germany, while talk radio bloviators warn every day that the U.S. is lurching into tyranny. As a conservative who served in the last three Republican administrations, I find this kind of strident rhetoric to be self-defeating. True conservatism isn't a rigid ideology, but a pragmatic philosophy based on centuries of human experience and awareness of the limitations of politics. The conservative temperament is fundamentally grateful, not angry or resentful. Think of the sunny optimism of Ronald Reagan. If Republicans want to win the presidency in 2016, we need to nominate another reassuring salesman for free market conservative principles. A uniter, not a divider. And from Richard Cohen at the Washington Post, the price of the great disruption. Technology is killing the American middle class, said Richard Cohen. Automation and digital technology have wiped out millions of manufacturing, service, and other blue-collar jobs in recent decades, and that worrisome trend is picking up speed. Car companies and Google are working on driverless cars that could, in the not-distant future, eliminate the jobs of 3.5 million truck drivers, not to mention cooks and waitresses at thousands of truck stops. Technology produces great wealth for people in executive and management jobs, but not for the workers. In the new power curve of digital companies, 80% of the rewards go to 20% of the people in the firm. Optimists say we'll just have to retrain the middle class for the new economy, as if everyone could become programmers and app inventors. In whispers, captains of industry tell me it's more likely that the government will have to launch make-work projects for the middle class, like those created during the Depression. The term disruptor has become an accolade, but what is being disrupted is not the occasional industry, but the American dream. And this international column, under the How They See Us heading, conspiring to keep oil cheap. Is the precipitous drop in the global oil prices an American conspiracy? Asked Gwen Dyer and Hürriyet from Turkey. That's what Russia, Iran, and Venezuela claim. Venezuelan President Nicolas Maduro recently declared that the U.S. had launched a strategically planned war aimed at destroying the economies of oil-dependent foes. This fiendishly clever strategy, the theory goes, has seen the U.S. deliberately flood the market with shale oil to sink the price of crude. The same argument has been heard from Russian and Iranian leaders who, like their Venezuelan counterparts, need oil to be more than $100 a barrel to balance their budgets. It's true that those countries have suffered as oil prices have fallen from over $115 per barrel last June to under $50 today. But to suggest that the U.S. is exploiting its shale reserves for political rather than economic purposes is utterly illogical. Does Maduro really think that America should have left that shale oil in the ground so it could remain dependent on the expensive foreign oil? Why on earth would it want to do that? You're leaving out a crucial element of the conspiracy, said Manuel Isidro Molina in Crónicas Venezuela. Saudi Arabia is in on it, too. Riyadh should have responded to the gush of U.S. shale oil by cutting back on production, helping prop up the global price. Instead, the sheikhs kept on pumping because they've made a secret agreement with the Obama administration to flood the market with oil at huge discounts. Whether Venezuela is the target of this conspiracy or whether our economic pain is collateral damage is irrelevant. The effect is the same. President Obama has admitted to the plot, said Jawad al-Bashiti in Al-Watan from Oman. He told American radio last month that he hit Moscow with sanctions after the annexations of Crimea because he knew they would leave Russia's economy vulnerable to an inevitable disruption in oil prices. Saudi Arabia, which has enough savings in the bank to support decades of budget deficits, has its own reason for wanting lower oil prices. It fears a coming U.S.-Iranian rapprochement will give its archenemy Iran greater regional influence and hopes that by weakening Iran's economy, it will weaken its negotiating position and political power. If there's a plot afoot, it's a solely Saudi one, says Sandile Shisabana in the Business Times from South Africa. The kingdom is simply applying a highly predatory pricing strategy. Had it cut production, it would have been effectively subsidizing the U.S. oil industry. Shale oil is expensive to extract and needs to sell at around $85 a barrel to be profitable. As it is, the price has dropped so low that American shale oil is no longer economical for investors and no longer competes with the cheaper Saudi crude. The winner of this economic battle is Saudi Arabia. Our in-depth article this week is titled, The Club for Graying Daredevils. At the Adventurers Club, said Zach Urbina, members swap tales of kayaking the Nile and circling the globe. In 1986, Dick Rutan flew with a co-pilot in a Rutan Model 76 Voyager, a custom-designed and built aircraft covering 26,000 air miles and taking 9 days to circumnavigate the globe, unrefueled, nonstop. After taking off from Edwards Air Force Base in Southern California, the plane headed west, making 2 passes over the equator, avoiding a 600-mile-wide typhoon, and doubling back over inhospitable Libyan airspace. Rutan piloted the plane without a break for the first 3 days of the 9-day flight. When the plane finally landed, it had a damaged wing and 1.5% of the fuel with which it originally departed. Rutan's Voyager aircraft now hangs in the Smithsonian, part of an exhibit celebrating human accomplishments in flight. Once in a great while, the tanned 76-year-old will share his story, but only for those select members of the Adventures Club of Los Angeles. The bylaws of the club, which caps membership at 200, make it very clear that only those who have had an unusual adventure on land, at seas, or in the air, hunting, trapping, exploring, flying, or those who have attained a distinctive reputation in the field of arts, music, or science, are considered eligible. North of downtown Los Angeles, just past Chinatown and Lincoln Heights, one can easily miss the building where the Adventurers Club meets. Absent of signage or decor, the windowless, anachronistically beige structure sits opposite a 99-cent store. The look and feel of the club's interior could be best described as a ramshackle museum of both living and recently deceased world lore. At the top of the stairs, a massive polar bear greets visitors, posed by a taxidermist mid-swipe. Elsewhere, there are animal trophies from around the world. Lions, gazelles, boars, even a mammoth skeleton replete with enormous tusks. The walls are lined with chevrons, war medals, model airplanes, and wooden plaques with handsome brass nameplates holding successful etchings dating back decades. There are photos everywhere, primarily of previous and current members clad in pith helmets, diving gear, flight suits, trapper hats, tuxedos, double-breasted blazers, and an even mix of neat mustaches, full beards, and cleanly shaven faces. There are many, many maps alongside knives, swords, spears, canoes, flags, coats of arms, portraits of sea captains and sailing ships, native adornments and jewelry, vintage pictures of airplanes, actual propellers, and at least one mannequin of a diver in chainmail. These are the collected histories and exploits of men. The Adventurers Club remains first and foremost a men's club, with only male members, though it does have a regular ladies' night, on which women are permitted to attend. The club was founded in 1921, and the core of its membership is older, many in their 60s, 70s, and 80s. Past members include Los Angeles philanthropist John Anson Ford and polar bear explorer Roald Amundsen. Filmmaker and explorer James Cameron is listed as esteemed member number 1129. Discussions of business or politics here are strictly forbidden. Embellishment of exploits is not tolerated. If you misrepresent facts about your adventures, you are likely to be humiliated by someone who traversed the geography you are attempting to embellish, and if you're discovered, you'll be quickly repudiated in front of everyone. Despite all this, there is a jovial, warm-hearted tone during Thursday night dinners, when $20 buys the guest of a member a home-cooked meal, meatloaf, rice, veggies, and apple pie a la mode on one recent evening. A can of beer goes for $2, a soda for $1. Some of the club members are pilots, surfers, documentarians, former servicemen, and commissioned officers. They carry with them war stories, obscure geographic references, a sense of momentum unhampered by age, and bucket lists bordering elite-level completion. Ask anyone who's visited the club, and he knows Pierre's stories. 74-year-old Pierre Audier is a two-time club president who has also sat on the board of directors for 23 years. Audier speaks seven languages and estimates that he's traveled to somewhere between 160 and 170 countries. "When I was 17, I wanted to see the pyramids, so I went to Africa," he says. "My parents were against it, but they didn't try to stop me. It started early, and I've been doing it ever since." Most recently, he built a school in Cambodia and taught students to live off the land on the Yucatan Peninsula. His frequent travels make Odier one of the most esteemed members of the club, but his attitude is calm and welcoming. He wears a goatee, frameless glasses, and a short haircut. The tails he shares are exotic, but they are not fish tails. They feel more like reportage. In 2010, Odier presented a talk about his adventure on Devil's Island, off the coast of French Guiana, surrounded by jags of rocks and currents so strong they offer hospitality only to sharks. Odier was able to get to Devil's Island only after befriending a helicopter pilot who had responded to an emergency call in which a member of the French Foreign Legion had cracked open his head while carousing with friends in a recreation area on nearby St. George Island. The helicopter pilot later forgot about the planned pickup rendezvous, and Odier was forced to make camp overnight. Ordered built by Napoleon III in 1852, the penal colony, a series of sites around French Guiana, once housed more than 70,000 French prisoners, anarchists, felons, repeat offenders, sent to the tropical wasteland amid the 19th century European population boom and commensurate rise in crime. On average, roughly 1 in 10 inmates survived. In 1938, René Belbonnois, one of the tiny handful of prisoners to escape Devil's Island, wrote a book called Dry Guillotine about the atrocious conditions on the island, which led to vast public outcry and the prison's eventual closing. Belbonnois later became a member of the Adventurers Club of Los Angeles. Recounting his own adventures on Devil's Island, where he was researching a small cemetery that had no official record, Odier expounded upon the importance of reading a map, a talent vanished by omnipresent smartphones, and how to bond with perfect strangers when dealing with gaping language barriers to put them at ease. Odier's affect is decidedly disarming, owing perhaps to his Swiss origin. It seems abundantly clear, as with virtually all of the gentlemen members, he is a man of the world. It doesn't take long to realize that every individual between these hallowed walls contains within them a library of life experience. The more senior he is, the deeper the library goes. My first encounter with the club included a talk from Mark Weitz, an attorney who resides in downtown Los Angeles. White's recent trip to Guyana, Suriname, and French Guiana placed his total number of countries at 87. White showed the club photos of tropical overgrowth near Jonestown, where he traveled through on foot, shots from inside Devil's Island, and images of the European Space Agency launch of the Ariane rocket only 5 degrees from the equator. One of the younger adventurers at 39, Weitz had joined the rank and file of the officially adventurous 6 years earlier after reading about the African exploits of John Goddard, who once kayaked the entire Nile River and later wrote a book about it. Weitz contacted the club when he heard Goddard would be presenting. Though Weitz represents the new guard, his demographic is largely outnumbered. Without an infusion of lifeblood of new members, the Adventurers Club is very likely to fade entirely. How many Gen Y millennials can tell you what an SR-71 is or understand the archetypal machismo of a man like Teddy Roosevelt? As the globe grows ever more tightly connected, the skills of individual resiliency, camaraderie, and courage that each member clearly holds dear have faded from prominence. Inside the club's quarters during a recent meeting, Al Enderley carried a tri-folded pamphlet filled with Xeroxed copies of the story of his life. Closing in on 80, Enderley, who graduated from the U.S. Naval Academy in 1952, boasts 20-plus children, either biological or by marriage. In his life story, he recounts his experiences as a private pilot, hang glider enthusiast, scuba diver, water skier, motorcyclist, hiker, lecturer, and editor-at-large. His personal and professional exploits covered in the pamphlet include personally selected Bible passages as well as a staunch commentary defending the teachings of Jesus Christ. Another member, Gary Harland, now in his 60s, has served 20 years in the Navy, the Coast Guard, and the Air National Guard. His first adventure came at age 11 when he hopped a passenger train, riding on the back steps of the last car from the city of San Fernando, California, to the Mojave Desert. Harland has an adventure resume heavy on verbs, with categories like ships I crewed on, aircraft flown, boats sailed, and mountains climbed. With a tally of 39 countries under his belt, his adventuring experience came to him first in the military and then as a merchant mariner, when, following his return from service, he grew restless at a desk job. "They had me in this little office, and I just couldn't stand it," Harland said. "Your life is more exciting in the military. You don't know where you're going to end up." He has since sailed for Military Sealift Command and Maersk Line, the largest shipping company in the world with more than 20,000 employees supporting 600 vessels, the largest of which hold up to 18,000 shipping containers during one voyage. In 2004, Harland's voyage on the Norwegian Cruise Lines was thwarted when a fluke accident sank the 900-foot vessel while berthed at the Lloyd Werft shipyard in Bremerhaven, Germany. Officially, Harland is a retired electronics and communications officer, but he recently applied for a communications technician position on the Titanic II, a replica of the original RMS Titanic currently being planned, financed, and built by Australian billionaire Clive Palmer. Despite Harland's military service, international travel history, flight hours logged, and mountains climbed, he's unsure if he'll find a position on the ship. "It's something I would really like to do," he says. "Nothing ventured, nothing gained." This was excerpted from an article that originally appeared on narrative.ly, reprinted with permission. And we'll look now at the health and science page. A new tool in the war against obesity. A new device can help obese people lose weight by tricking their stomachs into feeling full, the Washington Post reports. The device, approved last week by the Food and Drug Administration, is implanted in the abdomen and uses electronic signals to help control feelings of hunger and fullness. The Maestro rechargeable system uses an electric pulse generator to stimulate the vagus nerve, which signals the brain when the gut is full or empty. In a year-long clinical trial involving 233 patients, those who were implanted with Maestro lost 8.5% more weight than patients in the control group. While Enteromedics, the company behind Maestro, was hoping for a 10% or better weight loss, the FDA nonetheless approved the device, as it resulted in sustained weight loss in patients who were unable to shed pounds using traditional methods. The Maestro is less invasive than bariatric lap band surgery and fills a significant gap in the currently available treatment options, says Enteromedics CEO Mark Knudsen. The device has been approved for use only in individuals with a body mass index from 35 to 45, roughly 75 pounds overweight, and who also suffer from other obesity-related conditions such as type 2 diabetes. More than one-third of American U.S. adults are obese, resulting in an estimated $147 billion in medical costs each year. A protein that fights dementia. A mechanism that protects the brains of animals during hibernation could provide a key for treating and preventing Alzheimer's disease and other forms of dementia. British scientists cooled the body temperatures of dormice to 60 to 64 degrees and isolated proteins that are released in the brain during cold shock. These proteins, including a critical one called RBM3, protect the brain during hibernation and rebuild synapses when the animal returns to normal body temperature. The researchers found that artificially boosting RBM3 levels in mice prevented Alzheimer's-like symptoms. Humans also have RBM3 in the brain, but in people with Alzheimer's, it is either absent or doesn't work. Lead researcher Giovanni Malucci tells FoxNews.com that the findings open the possibility of developing a drug or process that stimulates RBM3 in humans and mimics the protective effects of cold on the brain. Feeling cold is contagious. Just watching a video of a person in a cold environment can result in a temperature contagion, making your own temperature drop so much that you begin shivering, a new study has found. Researchers at the University of Sussex showed a group of volunteers videos of actors immersing their hands in vats of either steaming hot or ice-cold water. The volunteers in the group that saw the cold video felt cold all over, and their hands registered nearly a half-degree drop in temperature. The results are in keeping with previous studies of so-called emotional contagion, the process by which individuals spontaneously synchronize with and then mimic the behavior of others around them. Mimicking another person is believed to help us create an internal model of their physiological state, neuroscientist Neil Harrison tells telegraph.co.uk, which helps us better understand their motivations and how they are feeling. The same process has also been linked to how people pass along loneliness, laughter, and stress. Humans are profoundly social creatures, said Harrison. On the Talking Points page, climate change, the hottest year on record. So it's official, says Phil Platt in Slate.com. 2014 was the hottest year on record. Scientists from NASA and the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration said last week that while the eastern U.S. was cooler than usual last year, average global temperatures were the highest since record-keeping began back in 1880. That was particularly surprising in a year that didn't feature El Niño, the sporadic warming phenomenon that tends to drive temperatures up. So much for the pause in global warming. Deniers gonna deny, but the reality is that 10 of the 10 warmest years on record, 9 have taken place since 2000. It's now clear to any rational person that our continued reliance on fossil fuels is causing dangerous and irreparable damage to our planet. That's not clear at all, said Robert Trashinsky in TheFederalist.com. When climate scientists say 2014 was the hottest on record, they're talking about just 135 years of data, not the 6,000 years of human civilization. During that time, there were periods much warmer than today, with wine grapes growing in northern England and Newfoundland. On a geological timescale, the Earth has gone through a series of freezing and warming cycles on a scale of tens of thousands to hundreds of thousands of years. And just how large was the climb in 2014's temperatures? A mere 0.02 centigrade. The climate scientist's margin for error was five times as much, at 0.1 centigrade. If only the environmental evangelist could admit what their data actually show. Global temperatures have essentially been on a plateau since 1998. Don't fall for the climate denialist's favorite trick, says Kevin Drum in MotherJones.com. They always used 1998 as their base year because it was an outlier, an unusually warm year. But anyone can fool the rubes with misleading charts. The full chart from 1880 to 2014 shows an unmistakable trend line rising of rising temperatures. But with Republicans controlling Congress, Don't expect any major policy changes out of Washington, said Steven Stromberg in WashingtonPost.com. A recent Pew Research Center poll found that only 15% of Republican voters want government to make climate change a top priority. Even among all Americans, climate change comes in 22nd among issues of pressing concern. It may take even greater evidence of warming and a younger generation of leaders before the U.S. takes global warming seriously. Another Talking Points article, Oscars, a Hollywood whitewash. The 2015 Oscar nominations are out, said Danielle Belton in NBCNews.com, and the winner is white men. For the first time since Titanic swept the floor in 1998, all 20 acting nominees are white, and every nominee in the Best Director, Screenwriter, Screenplay Adapter, and Original Score Composer categories is a white man. In an inexplicable snub, the widely praised civil rights epic Selma earned just two nominations, Best Picture and Best Original Song, with the Academy snubbing director Ava DuVernay and lead actor David Oyelowo in the role of Martin Luther King Jr. It appears the award ceremony is going with a throwback theme, whites only. Why is anyone surprised? Asked Todd Vanderwerf in Vox.com. The 6,000 industry professionals who vote in the Oscars are 94% white and 77% male and have an average age of 63. If Selma had been directed by Clint Eastwood instead of a young black woman, it would have racked up nomination after nomination. Hold on, said Mark Harris in Grantland.com. It was only a year ago that 12 Years a Slave was being showered with Oscars, including one for its black director. Have Academy voters turned more racist in a year? The boring truth is that Selma was snubbed because of release timing and campaign strategy. Films released later than the beginning of December rarely fare well with the Academy voters, and Paramount didn't send DVDs of the film to industry guilds, a crucial way of building up enthusiasm in the rank and file. Selma's award prospects were also harmed by a controversy over whether the film misrepresented President Lyndon Johnson's role in the civil rights movement. Paramount was caught flat-footed by the charges and never quite recovered. Nonetheless, there is no doubt that Hollywood has a serious diversity problem, said Tim Gray in Variety.com. For the 10 highest-grossing films of 2014, women accounted for just 7 of the 27 producers and 6 of the 26 writers. All 10 movies were directed by white men. That's inexcusable, said David Carr in the New York Times. But let's look at the bright side. Even if DuVernay wasn't nominated, it's encouraging that a major studio hired a young female black director to make a film as important as Selma. Long after the last blubbering actor has been played off the stage while thanking his or her makeup assistant at the Oscars, we'll still have Selma. And a few short notes. Millennials will this year officially overtake baby boomers as the largest generation alive in the U.S., according to the new analysis of Census Bureau data. Defined as the generation born from 1981 to 1997, millennials will number 75.3 million Americans in 2015. Boomers born in the two decades following World War II will number 74.9 million this year. In an effort to curtail the nasty infighting of the 2012 primaries, the Republican National Committee has sanctioned 9 GOP primary debates for the 2016 presidential campaign, 11 fewer than last time. The movie Selma could not use the actual words of Martin Luther King's historic speeches because the King family holds the copyright on the speeches and sells rights to use them. The family has sued networks, newspapers, and documentary makers for using those speeches. Holding a single prisoner at Guantanamo Bay cost $3.3 million per year, more than 40 times the cost of holding a prisoner in a supermax prison in the U.S. The combined wealth of the world's richest 1% will overtake that of the other 99% in the world's population by 2016, according to a study by the anti-poverty group Oxfam. The study also found that the richest 80 people in the world have collected the same amount of wealth, $1.9 trillion, as the 3.5 billion people in the bottom economic half of the global population. On the poll watch, 50% of Americans think that the U.S. economy improved in 2014, and 45% are satisfied with the state of the economy, the highest percentage in 8 years. A year ago, just 28% were satisfied with the economy. Just 19% of Americans view possible GOP presidential candidate Jeb Bush positively. 32% see him negatively. And a couple of quotes from Mark Twain. Against the assault of laughter, nothing can stand. That was quoted in the Knoxville, Tennessee News Sentinel. And we'll finish up with a quote from Dr. Martin Luther King Jr., quoted in ChristianPost.com. In the end, we will remember not the words of our enemies, but the silence of our friends. Well, we've run out of time for today's episode of the week. Be sure to listen again next time. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Fred Woodward. The Triangle Radio Reading Service wishes to thank Charlie and Carolyn Kerr for their support of today's Reading of the Week magazine. This program honors Charlie's sister, Bonnie Cassidy, who continues to be a true inspiration to their family. The content of this program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. This broadcast is available as a podcast right after the broadcast at our website, TriangleReadingService.org. If you have questions or comments, give us a call at 919-832-5138. So long until next time.